Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
This is the BBC.
Hiya, thanks for downloading the show. My name is Susan Kalman. I'm a comedian and this is my podcast, Mrs. Brightside, a cheerful take on depression. Yes, comedy and depression, bit of a weird one, isn't it? The thing is, I like to make misery funny and I think other people feel the same way. And I wanted to make this podcast because I think we should all talk more about our mental health and remove some of the stigma surrounding it. I've invited 8 amusing people into a basement in Soho to bare their souls to me. I didn't have any questions. It's not a traditional interview. I just wanted to chat to them about what they thought about their own heads. There's no parameters. There's no definitions. It's just coming from them and me. Today, I'm talking to Al Murray.
If you come on going, oh, look at you wankers, why are you laughing at this shit? And it took me 6 hours to get here. And have you any idea how tired I am and all that? And then if you add into that, and my wife's left me. And then I suppose you can end up in sad clown territory.
Now, you might know Al better as the pub landlord. I've never actually seen him do a show as the pub landlord. I just know him as a really nice fella I've met out and about at the Edinburgh Fringe. And I was really fascinated to hear his take on mental health and depression. And it turned out it was even better than I thought it was going to be. Any Fringe dates this year, Al?
No, I'm taking the year off.
Good.
Because we had a baby in December.
A little baby.
So I've got an 18-year-old and a zero-year-old. And the 18-year-old's all like, oh, it's one in, one out, is it? It's all that sort of thing.
Yes.
Because she has grown up and gone.
Yes.
And been replaced.
Thank you for coming and sitting in a basement with me.
It's great. This is what a proper one of these Fringe radio stations should be like. It's not in a big shiny office, is it?
No, it's not.
We're crammed into the available space with a weird window inside
a
room.
As the temperature rises, it becomes more and more uncomfortable, which I think is the perfect place to talk about depression, Al. I take you to feel comfortable.
That's good.
So, I mean, what this is... Mm. I've been depressed.
Yes.
In my life. And I'm fascinated by other people's experiences of it, whatever that means.
Yeah.
There are no restrictions about what we talk about. I've been depressed and it's helped me to talk about it and talk to other people.
Yeah.
And
well, I'm always worried about talking about this as a comedian, because I get very fed up with the idea that comedians all want to kill themselves. And the idea of the sad clown, all those things. They're journalism, those ideas about, in my experience, comedians are the same cross-section of people as any other group of people. You know, you've got the happy ones, the ones who are loyal, the shaggers, the gloomy people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which obviously means that if they're a cross-section of people like any other cross-section of people, there will be people who suffer from depression just the same. It's not because they're comedians. You know, it's Tony Hancock kills himself, John Cleese goes on about being miserable, and suddenly we're all supposed to be the clown in that famous joke. You know the joke where the guy goes to see the psychiatrist says, oh, you need to go see, Maximo the clown. He's absolutely hilarious. He shines light where there is none and all this sort of thing. He's absolutely brilliant. And then the guy goes, I am Maximo the clown or whatever.
Yes.
You know, it really frustrates me, almost as much as seeing a picture of a comedian holding a microphone. The idea that
with one hand in their pocket,
looking
quizzical.
There's a movie at the moment, it's a Maxine Peake film about stand-up, which I'm sure is really
Funny
good.
Funny Cow, is it called?
Yeah,
Funny
that's right.
Cow, yeah.
But the artwork is her holding a microphone. I mean, for fuck's sake, right? I can cope with the idea that she's a comedian without needing to see an SM58 in her fist. Anyway, but that's not the point.
No.
The point I'm making is comedians are as likely as anyone else. We're not exceptionally prone to this sort of thing. And I really, I mean, it's interesting because we do do it. We do a job that, on the face of it, is much more stressful than a lot of what people do for a living. You know, the idea of going out and talking in front of people scares the bejesus out of most people.
Mm-hmm.
But comedians, in that respect, aren't most people. A lot of them really like it. That's why they do it. They love it. They love the attention.
Oh yeah, yeah. Self-indulgent, needy people.
Yeah, exactly.
Sociopaths, essentially.
Exactly.
Yes.
But that doesn't necessarily mean they're depressed.
No, it doesn't at all. But what it is in the same way as, and I'm not meaning to have a go at journalists this early on in our conversation, but in the same way as I'm constantly asked if women are funny.
Yeah, yeah. Jesus Christ.
Some women aren't. Some men aren't.
Yeah.
I've been to see many shows where I haven't laughed at all
at some
of the gentlemen. It's
comedians.
Thanks
for that. Yeah.
Look, you're very brave. it's the binary definition. Now, what I do think about comedians is we are self-indulgent. We are given, at the Fringe, 55 minutes to talk about whatever we want.
Yeah.
And what's the easiest thing to talk about? Us. Me.
Yeah.
How I feel.
Yeah. Although that is the thing. I mean, again, I've never done that. I've always, because I do a character, I'm never talking about how I feel about things at all. Or not as directly. So you won't get a review that says, oh, and he goes on about what, I'm not going to do what John Robbins did last year and talk about a breakup. I can't do that. I've never really known how to do that, and so everything I do has to go through this sort of filter. But that also means I could talk about things other than myself, which I think I'm much more comfortable not talking about myself.
Yes.
Certainly on stage, I'm not a kind of bit of me doesn't see why anyone would be interested as well. Because I very much became interested in performing as a way of constructing self confidence. Because when I was a teenager, I was very very self conscious. I went through a really at school assembly, I just assume everyone was looking at me. Not because aren't I fabulous, but because I think my feet are too big and I'm clumsy and I'm awkward and I'm lots of real sort of collapsing self-confidence questions. And so I thought, well, if performing is a self-confident act, I can construct self-confidence out of performance. And I think that's sort of that is why I've ended up a stand-up. It was a sort of when I remember being about 15, thinking, perform this rather than do it for real in a weird
yes.
way. And so that that's how I got into performing, and that's why I think on stage I don't do me and I don't talk about me, and or if I do, it's been so arrived at elliptically or taken and bent into something else. You don't get a personal snapshot of me on stage.
Yes. I liked comedy for many reasons. I'd always wanted to be a comedian, and I don't really know why. Well, but I found a Billy Connolly tape on my brother's desk when I was 12 or 13, and I put it into my Walkman. And I didn't really understand it, but I just knew this was the funniest thing I'd ever heard in my life. I mean, it really was. It was one of his early albums.
Yeah.
He was talking about walking down the street in Partick and trying to find a party.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely classic kind of Connolly. But in the 1990s...
Well, great place to start.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was my first experience. Yeah. And then Victoria Wood.
Yeah.
So essentially...
Bloody hell.
Yeah, I know. High hopes.
Yeah.
But in the 1990s, especially in Glasgow, especially as a woman, what stand-up?
Yeah.
It had fallen out of fashion.
Yeah.
On television as well, so it wasn't there. And what attracted me initially about comedy was it seemed to be full of weirdos.
Yeah.
Comedy's full of absolutely strange people.
Yeah.
And I loved that.
Yeah. Well, that's still the case. I mean, that was a huge attractor for me, because I got into doing comedy when I went to university, when I went to Oxford. And on my first afternoon, I met Stuart Lee and Richard Herring, because I had a drum kit and I was taking it to the college music room, and they were in there, and I said, oh, well, you know, hello, it's my first day. What are you doing? And they said, oh, we've just been at the Edinburgh Fringe, because they're in the year above me. Stuart still acts like he is. We've just been at the Edinburgh Fringe, like we've done a show, like, and all that. And they were putting it on again in a couple of weeks' time. Their triumphant return to the university scene. And basically, I had a light bulb. Oh, great, I could do that, because I wanted to act. But I didn't have the self-confidence to fail an audition for another someone like someone, another student like me, who knew, who I reckon probably knew fuck all. Because I went, you know, I went to boarding school, and all sorts of, I've, so I've all sorts of weird authority issues. And if the drama teacher cast me in something, I could cope with that. But if someone my age, who knew, who I knew as little as, knew as little as me,
yes,
didn't cast me, I wouldn't, my ego wouldn't have been able to deal with it. Whereas getting up in front of an audience, but I mean, standing at the back with all the weirdos and freaks who wanted to do comedy,
yeah,
like the back of the room, and then getting up in front of an audience and them laughing is a much, is a much more direct way of finding out if you're good at something than learning some lines and doing an audition. And that's what appealed to me. It's like, and it's still like that. It's still waiting at the back with the weird people,
yes,
and going on. That I mean, no matter what, where you end up playing, that is the thing that remains the same.
It does, thing. Yes, yeah. That thing of, it's always a curious thing. I don't think, I agree with your initial theory that comedians aren't all depressed.
Yeah.
Right? It's not the tears of a clown thing. It's just, it's somewhere where weird people feel at home.
Yeah.
Therefore, there might be slightly more of us simply because it's a place where we feel welcome. Yeah. We feel
but
welcome.
But there was a time where, and it's for completely traditional reason, I got divorced. We got divorced for lots of sad reasons. And I completely unraveled because I, as a touring so much as a comic, having home was enormously important to me. It was like the most crucial thing. And the reason I was able to do it, the reason I was able to go away, is because I had home to come to. And losing that, and you know, when people get divorced, however they try and slice it, someone is always less into it than the other person. You know, even no matter how amicable a situation appears to be, someone's more into it than the other.
Mm-hmm.
And someone always feels like they're having to leave. And I was completely smashed up by that for a year, but at exactly the same time as when I was doing the biggest live stuff I've ever done. So I was doing arenas, and so it's that thing, you have to haul myself out of the dressing room. Like, and gut miserable, you know,
yes,
soul sad,
yep,
everything miserable about me. And because you're on the road, drinking every night, which doesn't help.
No, it does not.
Although it did not help sometimes, you know, like sometimes it's, you just think, I've got to medicate somehow.
Yes.
Well, I don't know if I was depressed, but certainly it's the shittest I've ever felt. And getting up and doing the comedy was, interestingly, was 2 hours off from it.
Yes.
So 2 hours off feeling like dog shit, 2 hours off thinking, how am I ever going to work my way out all of these problems? Is there an end in sight? Now, of course, being on tour also meant there was, you know, there was going to be a point where the tour ended, and then I was going to have to go home, and there was no home.
Yes.
And that was incredibly difficult. And I found talking about that quite useful.
Mm-hmm.
Although, and I did go for some therapy, but I found myself talking around in circles. I ended up really liking the therapist. I wanted to talk about other stuff. you know, we kind of got on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so you end up, you won't believe what I saw in the paper. And because I can go off the subject quite quickly, as you probably realised. And that was about 10 years ago, and it was fucking terrible. Really, really like a year of being in a black hole.
Yep.
And I remember being completely stressed out once, and my doctor saying, "Oh, you need some beta blockers because you're going apeshit." Because I was sort of adrenalized all the time by
yes.
it, as well as
it's your fight or flight. Your body's fight or flight.
Yeah,
is saying I'm sad, so I'm going to fight all the time.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
you're on edge and anxious all
yeah,
the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, it was awful. So he gave me the beta blockers, and I took one, and that was even worse. That was like being that was like being in a diving suit. You know, like
yeah.
Horrible, and everything was slow, and I'm thinking, well, I can't go on stage in this state, right? You know, I tried them on a day off, so they went the flush and down the loo, like those need to be nowhere near me. But it as a performer, you know, you like I say, you get the 2 hours off, and then it's like, what the fuck do I do now with these feelings? Because again, you are, you know, after a show, I'm normally adrenalized, my head's still spinning because I've had to organize all the people and all the material.
Yep.
Because of all the improvising and all that, so it's at least 3-4 hours where you're thinking, I'm elated from the show and I'm miserable because I've got a home to go to. I don't know mm-hmm. what's going to happen next in my life, all that sort of stuff. So, and I was completely impossible to deal with for about a year. And I remember a couple of years ago, my ex-wife said to me, "Oh, you know, I was thinking of going seeing some. Could you get me some tickets or something?" And I'm thinking, well, I didn't know we did each other favours. but why? Oh, I want to go see some comedy. I haven't really been able to go and see anything, you know, since the divorce. And I'm thinking, well, you. I remember thinking, well, in fact, I said to her, you tried fucking doing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
through all this.
Yeah.
For Christ's sake. So, I've friends who are depressed, and it usually manifests itself in drinking.
Yes.
Because that's our culture's go-to,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
And in our job, being fair, my first two fringes.
Yeah.
I've never been anywhere where you could drink till 5 a.m.
Yeah.
And actually, it's encouraged. It's part of what you do.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And now when I go to the Fringe, I don't drink.
Yeah.
Because I did 2 or 3 years of pretty excessive drinking.
Yeah.
And what it doesn't help is, A, it doesn't help my performance.
No.
And what I always think is, and this is why I also love comedy, I've been depressed. I've felt miserable. I've been whatever.
Yeah.
The people who've paid their money, often many months in advance.
Yeah, yeah.
Could not give two shits if I'm feeling sad that day, and should not give two shits if I'm feeling sad that day. And when I was drinking, I would get morose, and it would affect the subtleties of comedy. Fascinate me. When you walk on stage, people sense.
Oh, they know immediately.
Off
you. They smell it the moment you walk on stage. They know everything about what mood you're in. The moment you before you even get to the mic stand.
Yeah. Home, though, I mean, for me, home is one of the most important things. It is my sanctuary. It is my safe place. It is where no one can get me. No one can get me in my house.
Yeah.
And I jealously, and sometimes people, I say, I need to go home. Like with a rabid desperation in my face.
Yeah.
Because I know the point where I need to get home.
Yeah.
And it's, especially when you're touring. I mean, I was in Premier Inns. You were probably in better places than that, Al.
Maybe.
Premier Inns, where you wake up in the morning panicking because you don't know where you are because all the rooms look the same.
Yeah.
And that can add. And then you go out and you have to make people laugh.
Yeah.
And then afterwards someone comes up and says, I thought you'd be funnier.
Yeah.
And you suddenly go,
Yeah.
Because you've really tried.
But that's no one's business. None of that's anyone's business. You're absolutely right.
It's no one's business.
You're there to lead a service between the audience have come to be with the laughter god, and it's almost like you say to them, "We're part of a community because we've all got the same. We all kind of laugh at the same stuff because you're here to see me.
Yeah.
So we all believe in the same things. We're all going to laugh together, and it's almost like." There's sometimes when you especially when you play really enormous gigs, like over 2,000 seats. There's almost a thing like where you kind of say to the audience, "Laugh now," and they laugh.
Yes.
And it's like you're the literally the intercessor. You're the person between the audience and the laughter, and you're guiding them through the whole thing. And Steve Martin talked about that in his book.
I love his book,
Born which is
Standing
amazing. Up. Yeah,
it's
amazing,
a fantastic book.
Yeah, really amazing. And anyone who's interested in comedy should read it because the most brilliant thing about it is he says. At the start of the book, he goes, this is what happened to me. It bears no relation to anyone else's experience. Yeah. This is just how I figured out an act, how I got good at it, how I then took it onto a big stage, and then how I got fed up with it. And you read it and you think, oh, that happened to me. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, it's just like when I did this. And it's quite extraordinary. He says at the end of the book, and I remember reading this when I was at the O2, and I was really, this is when I was mega miserable, and finding the arena gigs completely counterintuitive because we had screens up. So you think I've got to do a big performance because there's thousands of people here and they're miles away. But then you're in a medium close up, so they can see everything. So you've got to do a TV performance, and it's quite confusing, and it takes two or three, four or five to get used to. And also the front row are as far away as you are from me. But they're all looking at the screen over to the left or to the right. And it's complete. And it's like all your normal instincts, theatre instincts, big theatre instincts, go out the window. Anyway, so I'm sat there reading this. And I was really grumpy about doing these gigs. And we were filming and I was pissed off with the lighting guy and all this sort of thing. Really having a miserable time. And there's a bit in the book where he says, where I went wrong with those arena shows was I was trying to do my comedy the way I figured it out. And actually, you're there to be the host of a party. They've come to have a big party and you're there to be the host. And if they want the old jokes, give them the old jokes. If they want the things they love, give them the things they love. Because they don't realise that you know, you thought of that joke at 4 a.m. and you really love it and it's got to be this way round. They just want to hear it, right? Get over yourself. And that was really, you know, and I read this at my last, in the interval of my last reach. Oh, fuck! I've been going about this wrong. That long involved bit, I shouldn't have done that, you know. What did I do that for, you know? And why did I put that in? It was quite mean, and I should have left the mean bit out and all this sort of thing. And that, I think that's the point, is that you, just like you say, the audience, they don't give a shit.
No.
And you should take that into account. You should always have that, and, you know, and also that, because when I started out, there was a very self-destructive trend in stand-up. You know, if people got, there were some people, if they get laughs and then they go, what are you laughing at that for, you idiots? As kind of, and it's sort of that as a kind of a post-punk thing, you know, people didn't like polished performance when I started and they weren't into things being too slick. And they were, and there was a, that sort of postmodern thing of saying, you know, what on earth did you laugh at that for? That joke was rubbish and you laughed. You know, that kind of, it was that kind of thing. And it was kind of tied up in male self-confidence as much as anything else. And that was a really predominant view. And I remember at the time when I first started, I think, what the heck, why are you doing that? You know, audiences, they don't want to be made. They want to be told they're idiots for laughing at something. They don't want their noses rubbed in it and all that sort of thing. And you know, comics can develop snobbery about kinds of comedy. And they, in fact, do.
Yes.
But it's all, you know, why? And often enough, we develop snobberies about the kind of comedy we can't do. So I can't do the personal thing.
Yeah.
So I'm a bit like, well, why does anyone do that? Why does anyone bother talking? Make some stuff up, you wankers, is what was sort of my reaction to that. And in fact, that's just because I can't do it.
Yeah.
It's like I can't, you know, I think Brendan Byrne said that most comics end up doing the thing they're good at rather than the thing they really believe in. And it turns out to be a coincidence that the thing they really believe in is the thing they're good at. You know, just Tim Vine doesn't talk about himself. He's just daft, mad daft puns for an hour. I don't think that's because he thinks
started in comedy and thought I'm going to end up doing this. It just turns out he's incredibly
talented. Brilliant at. Yeah. So I don't know. So yeah, but there is that thing. You've got audiences. They don't. And you're absolutely right. Especially if they bought tickets months in advance.
Yeah.
And it's a big occasion. They've dressed up and they've had dinner beforehand, and all that sort of thing. And if you come on going, oh, look at you wankers, why are you laughing at this shit? And oh, it took me 6 hours to get here. And have you any idea how tired I am? And all that. And then if you add into that, and my wife's left me. And then I suppose you can end up in sad clown territory. But you're like the hotel receptionist in a way. The hotel receptionist should be always pleased to see you. We're in a service industry.
Yes. I think the thing is, I mean, mental health-wise, anxiety, and that can stretch to being overly self-analytical. I'm fascinated, like you are, with the aspect of comedy as a stage form. And
yeah.
I've been fascinated by Victorian spiritualism all my life.
Right.
Absolutely fascinated by it. The Fox Sisters, table tapping. And
oh, wow, brilliant.
I just think it's fascinating.
Yeah.
The origins of it, why they did it.
Yeah.
Tied up in all this kind of Victorian repression and everything else. And I go and see spiritualists a lot.
Right, wow.
Because they, I mean, hashtag not all spiritualists.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I've seen some remarkable performances which are simply performances where they are making stuff up. You know, but they're empaths.
Yeah.
And I think the best comedians are empaths.
Yeah.
Because they walk on stage and you can feel an audience. Your first joke, how did that, okay.
Yeah.
They're reticent, they're drunk, they're whatever it is. And I think in that way, comedians are like spiritualists.
Oh,
the old-fashioned spiritualists.
I couldn't agree with you more. That's absolutely right. That's when Tom Binns started doing that, Ian de Montfort.
Yes.
It's just what he's doing is he's doing... It's brilliant, that act. It's really, really funny. And what he's doing is he's basically doing crowd work, stand-up crowd work, but you only have to change it. You have to tilt it 5 degrees left and it turns into turns into spiritualism. Is there anyone here called John? John, you're not happy with your job, are you? I mean, how easy is that? And yep. No, you're absolutely right. Because I do so much crowd work. And very often I'll say to someone, sometimes you get this, you just get this thing and you get the right kind of person. You say, you've got a black Labrador called mm-hmm. Max, haven't you? And he goes, well, no, it's called Buster. And you're there. You've done, it's exactly the same thing. And if you're, and the other thing is practice with that makes perfect because.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You just get used to swimming in the audience feelings and mm-hmm. vibes and all that sort of thing. That's a very, spiritualists are.
But when you look at, so what a spiritualist does,
yeah.
What, there's one in particular I went to see, best night of my life.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm looking for a vet. Is there someone called a vet in the audience? Is a vet here? I'm looking for a vet. A vet's definitely here.
Yeah.
And someone went, my name's Marion and I work in a vet. That's you. That's who I'm looking for.
Yeah.
That's who. And it
fucking
was like,
bingo.
Jesus Christ. But what they do.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, it was, I mean, and then at the end of the show, this particular spiritualist said, does anyone have any questions? And I put my hand up and I don't know what he didn't ask me. I don't know whether he could tell because I very much believe in other things and remnants of soul and all that
all
kind
right.
of stuff. I mean, I think there's definitely, we are fascinating human beings and something happens. But I also believe in shysters.
Yeah.
And so he stands there in exactly the way I do.
Yeah.
Okay. Who's on the front row? Right. You look like you're trouble. You've been dragged here. That's what I get a lot. Men dragged by wives.
Yeah.
You've been dragged here. Yeah. You're not happy about it.
Yeah.
Right, okay. And you look, and in the same way as the spiritualist did, who's an easy target?
Yeah.
Not an easy, I don't mean that patronising.
No, soft, just
who's going to be open to conversation?
Yeah. Who am I going to be able to work with better?
And I love it because I love the Victorians.
Yeah.
I love Victorian lunatic asylums.
Yeah.
I find what they are, psyche at that point fascinating.
Well, that's yes. I made a program about Victorian lunatic asylums a couple of years ago, because this is the Wikipedia fact about me. My great 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 grandfather is William Thackeray, right? Who wrote Vanity Fair.
Yeah.
And his wife suffered probably postnatal depression after their second child, and I think they had a third child died. I can't remember. I ought to know. My mum will go, oh, he doesn't know the family history, right? And he did everything he could to get her cured that Victorians would do, but early Victorians. So not people tend to, I think of Victorians as the sort of austere end of, you know, the end of the century rather than the middle of the century. And he took her to France wasn't an insane asylum. It was a hospital where they believed in a cure for people suffering from what they called insanity, where they were asked to look after themselves and they'd live in a house and they'd do talking cure and they'd live in the countryside and they'd be taken to a stress-free environment. And then that didn't work, right? And then they took her to he took her to Germany for a water cure, where there was a guy who believed that basically if you were doused in water and cold water endlessly and drank loads of water, it would basically wash whatever was causing the insanity out of it. That didn't work, right? And then they went back to Paris and did some cupping stuff, and then she ended up in basically just being looked after by a family that he paid for. And so Thackeray lived this peculiar life where he All he ever wanted, because he'd inherited a load of money and blew it when he went to university, when he went to Cambridge on gambling. All he ever wanted to get back to that financial state, but he couldn't do it because he had to pay for his wife's care and all this sort of thing. And so he was always churning out novels to try and meet this care requirement. Anyway, so you have that. And what happened was the Victorians started off by thinking they could cure insanity and had the sort of optimism of science and the new scientific discovery and all that. And by the end of the century, it basically gone, ain't nothing we could do about this. Mm. And so people would end up incarcerated for life. And you end up with the asylums start out, those mega buildings, you know, start out as places of healing and end up basically as jails. And it's very strange. And then the really odd thing about this, Thackeray's daughter then married a guy called Leslie Stephen, who was Virginia Woolf's father in his second marriage. And they had so I've got a cousin, this cousin, Laura Stephen, and she was born with probably a learning difficulty or something, because you can't do any of the retrospective diagnosis. And he was a thrusting Fabian, Victorian liberal thinker, couldn't cope with the fact he had a daughter who had basically what was, he thought it was from a grandmother, from Thackeray's wife.
Yes.
Thought it was the stain, you know.
The curse, the genetic curse. Yes, absolutely, yeah.
And so he had Laura, they couldn't cope with Laura, and she ended up in a mental hospital, and then she died in, you know, spent a whole life in institution, died in the Priory in 1944, like abandoned by a family.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever Virginia Woolf comes up on things, I always think, yeah, what about your sister, you fucker? You know, because she's hailed as...
Yeah.
And they abandoned Laura. They put her in a hospital, abandoned her. And all that is, it's fascinating because, you know, we're talking about, you know, via discussion about comedy. We're talking about mental health. It's being discussed. People are trying to figure out what to do about it. There was an article in the Times at the weekend, this depression idea that it's in bodily inflammation, so it's a fight or flight response.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the stress is, our reaction to stress hasn't changed, but the stresses we face has changed. So the body's trying to deal with fear and fright and being knocked off balance. And the end result of that is depression because there's an excess of a reaction because we're stressed all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are talking about it, all that. Whereas what the Victorians did is they went, ain't nothing we can do about that.
Yeah.
And locked people away. And that is really, you know, it's, I suppose that's progress, but there's still a stigma, there's still taboo,
stigma. And whenever, I mean, part of this is simply talking about it is better than the brutality of what happened, which is if we ignore it, then it's not there.
Yeah.
But what fascinates me about the Victorians, those asylums are just fascinating structures.
Yeah.
And I spoke to Kevin Audley about this on Strictly because they always had a ballroom.
Yeah.
And so you had this tremendously brutal treatment of people at times. Electroshock therapy, hydrotherapy, terrible things, lobotomies.
Yeah.
And then you would have a ballroom. And I remember I did some work with a mental health course at one point and a woman on it, we were saying to them, come up with sketches. Because what's great about comedy is you don't need to write it down.
Yeah.
So you don't need to have literacy necessary to tell what you want to say. And she did this brilliant sketch because she'd been in a hospital of how differently people dance on different medication.
Brilliant.
And it was lovely. And I love the idea that the Victorians, no matter what was happening, had these ballrooms.
Yeah.
Because that's what you did.
Yeah.
And I just find them fascinating. And what also, I did a documentary not that long ago about the decriminalisation of homosexuality.
Yeah, yeah.
And as part of it, looking at the treatment of gay people.
Yeah.
And we were getting electroshock therapy until fairly recently.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was a mental illness.
Yeah, yeah.
Being gay. And it's fascinating that the reason why I'm so evangelical about talking about it is so that we don't ever return to those days again.
Yeah, but you've got the I mean, I don't know, my daughter's generation, my oldest daughter's 18, she won't mind me talking about this. She's had her ups and downs, and you like so many things with teenagers, but with people, you lead the horse to water, but you can't get them to drink. And therapy, famously, you've got to want You've got to want it to work.
Yes.
And one of the things, if you are depressed, one of the things that depression really wants is to remain in charge. And I know that's called personalizing or whatever, but the depression isn't interested in going away. It isn't interested in you doing anything about it. So we'll say to you, there ain't no point doing this therapy. Nothing's going to work. Mm-hmm. And that is, I mean, you know, the therapy I've had, I went into going, right, this is going to fix me. Mm-hmm. That's a better attitude. It's not necessarily a realistic attitude, but it's a better attitude than going and going with your arms lit, with your arms folded figuratively and literally. You know, this isn't what's the point? What's the fucking point of this? Depression does is depression goes, no way. You're not, you know, it's like people who drink. I mean, I always think, again, to come back to drinking is always, if someone's drinking a lot, they're miserable. That's really kind of the only explanation. And drinking is such, I mean, I stopped last year for a bit because I'd got to the end of a summer holiday and then a fringe. And I did 10 days at the fringe last year. And basically I've been, and we were on a long summer holiday. And I'd been pissed for 5 weeks, 6 weeks, pretty much.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
Not pissed every night, but I'd drink every night, yes. And then fringe pissed like a ramp going up the ramp. By the end of the fringe, every night I got shit faced, and I thought, right, I'd actually need to stop. And, you know, so I did triathlon or something, you know, one of those things.
Mm.
And I remember the first week. And the thing is this is one of those things, you don't notice it until you go through it. The first week, there was a little voice going, this decision would be easy to make if you had a drink. This, and not worrying about that would become a lot easier if you had a drink. You know what would go really well right now with, and it wasn't to do with, hey, let's have a good time. That wasn't what the little voice was saying. The little voice was saying, if you had a drink now, you'd worry less about that deadline. If you had a drink now, you could put off doing your diary till tomorrow or the VAT or whatever. And then you realise what the booze has been doing all this time.
Mm-hmm.
That the good times don't enter into your thought process with drinking at all. It's to do with the grip it gets on you is...
Yeah.
If this will all go away, literally anesthetic. And I remember, I thought, right, well, the best way to deal with this is I'll write about it. So sat down and wrote about this because I'm a big believer in, you know, order your thoughts, process them, and the best way to do it is write. So I sat down and wrote about it, and that made the little voice go away. But I had a full week of yes. And this is from a summer of getting pissed because I was on holiday and it's the festival, not because I'm freaking out about stuff or stressed about stuff or nervous about going on stage or worried about paying the bill. You know what I mean?
Mm.
None of those things. But when you take the drink away, you realise that that's what it's lined itself up to do, mm-hmm. in your psyche. And actually, the only way to deal with that is to stop and say to the little voice, get fucked.
Yeah.
you have no business in my brain.
One of the things that I'm very careful about how much I drink.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with alcohol, but I'm aware of the fact I could.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have an addictive personality,
yeah.
Right? So I've only been to a casino once. I love Elvis.
Yeah.
So I went to Graceland's and Tupelo, Mississippi and all that stuff. I went on an Elvis pilgrimage and I ended up at a casino. Never been to a casino before in my life. Proper casino, no windows, free food, free drink.
Yeah,
you know,
the
proper
whole,
American
whole
casino.
Whole 9 yards, yeah.
And I think I spent, and this was in the mid-90s, about £6,000 in an evening.
Bloody hell.
Because I just put my credit card and went, this is the most amazing thing I've ever done. I only paid it off, that credit card off, about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I, that morning, brilliant. When it was over, went, you can never go in a casino again.
Yeah.
You must never gamble. Yeah. You must never do anything.
Yeah.
And I see, not in my family, but alcohol has affected very badly people I know.
Yeah.
And I know myself, and the fringe was kind of what brought it to light. I could really do this all the time. And when I've had a terrible show, just go and get pissed.
Yeah. And it's a good show.
Yeah.
Go and get pissed.
Go and get pissed. You haven't got a show. Go and get
really,
pissed.
You might as well get pissed.
You might as well get pissed. Yeah. And it's a strange thing. And when I started doing comedy, I'd never been around so much alcohol in my life. Yeah. I mean, we work, especially when you're starting off on the circuit.
Yeah,
it's a pub.
Pubs, yeah.
It's a pub. Yeah. And I think having the awareness of... So when I tour now, I try and have a weekend a month at home.
Yeah.
Once a month, I'll book myself into a hotel that's not a Premier Inn.
Yeah.
So I feel better about myself. Yeah. And you get kind of better at taking care of our heads.
Yeah. The better hotels don't necessarily solve the problem. this happened ages ago, but it's exactly illustrative of your point. There's the Hotel Divan in Birmingham, a very nice hotel, right? And I've stayed there a lot, and now we don't stay there anymore because they put me in this room one time, and then we went back 18 months later, and I go in the room, and it's the same room, right? And it really, because it's got a really odd layout, and it because they tend to convert office blocks or whatever, and it really spooked me. I was really spooked by it being the same room.
Mm-hmm.
And I had complete, total recall of being in the room the time before, what music I'd listened to, exactly which tunes I'd listened to on my mm-hmm. iPhone and all this sort of thing. And I got properly spooked by it. Really like actual Groundhog Day feelings. And I went down to the bar, and it's the same barman, and he pours me a glass of what I'd had last time. It was like welcome back. It was like The Shining. Welcome back, Mr. Torrance. You've always been here, right? And he says, "How you doing, Al? Good to see you. What you been up to since I last saw you?" And I said, "I don't know. I don't know what I've. It's been the same since." And the 18 months in between were completely compressed, disappeared. And it's like I'd never left. And so the next time we stayed there, I'm like, I am staying in a different fucking room. I'm not staying in that room. And they put me in another room, which is the floor above, which is identical, right? Because it's the floor above, identical mm-hmm. layout. And I kicked off and I went down to reception. "You've put me in the same room as last time." They get the records out and they go, "We haven't, sir." And I'm like, yes, you did. And I really behaved quite badly. And they, you know... A bit like the comedy audience, they don't know that. They don't know, you know what I mean? They don't understand why. Mm-hmm. And I was really, "Are you bastard?" You know, like really unhappy about it. So we don't stay there anymore. But it's that thing of that groundhog thing. It really knocked me sideways.
It's sometimes very difficult.
Yeah, poor comedian, poor no. luxury hotel whinges.
Oh, God, they put me in the same room.
Yeah,
oh, my God.
Yeah.
When I'm stressed, I'm stressed right now. My book's due tomorrow.
Yeah. Right.
I'm stressed about a lot of things just now. Very stressed. And when I'm like that, I don't deal with things particularly well.
Right.
So I've started exercising a lot. I do boxing and weightlifting and it's really helped because I love it. And I was at a class and I was throwing a medicine ball and I wanted a lighter one because I'm a fanny.
Yeah.
And the gym instructor came up and said, "Why are you using that ball?" "Because I've injured myself in the past. You don't know me. You don't understand me. Why don't you leave me alone?" And the guy was like, "All right." Now, he thinks I'm a total dick.
Yeah, he just
But it's actually
dick.
Because when I'm in that zone, the smallest thing can make me just... And they don't know I've been up at 5 o'clock every morning for 3 weeks trying to write a sodding book about happiness.
No.
You know, but then you react.
Well, if one of the things is going to make you unhappy, it's doing that, isn't it?
It's making me desperately unhappy. Having to write chapters about how happy I am all the time is making me so unhappy. But I just, for me, I said in the first book that I wrote, comedy saved my life.
Yeah.
Not just the weirdos I hang out with. The ability to express myself, but I find it a stimulating thing.
Yeah.
I have a passion for the science of what we do.
Yeah.
But when I have an audience that comes in, I hang out the wings and I look at them.
Yeah.
And I love it.
Yeah.
I love looking at people. And I try and say, "Who am I going to talk to? Are you going to enjoy this?"
Oh, see, I don't you do know. That. I go on without, I don't want to know.
I look at them.
I go on and go on bang and take it on the chin.
No, I look at them. I look at them in the lobby sometimes. I look at them in the car park.
Really?
Yeah. I study them.
That's interesting.
To see if I can see, there's lots of groups. So, I mean, my audience, there's a lot of lesbians, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
A lot of Radio 4 listeners.
Yeah.
And I find my audience quite a strange demographic.
Yeah.
So I look at them and I think, I wish I was a mind. I hate the fact that Tom Binns is a mind reader, and I keep wanting to talk to him about it. I'd love to do a show where I genuinely try to see if I could push things that for that
well,
next step.
Cold reading's a set of techniques, though.
Yeah, I
so
love it.
You just got to learn them, haven't you?
Yeah, but I love the idea. I love. I had a dream to stay in every Grand Victorian hotel.
Yeah.
And cool. I love.
Yeah.
The one in Llandudno is extraordinary.
Yes, it is. Yeah. You stayed in the one in Buxton that overlooks
yes.
the city.
When I was in Llandudno, there was a guy and a Bon Tempe in the bar.
Brilliant.
Singing both parts of Islands in the Stream. One of the greatest nights of my entire life. But I find what we do, I think the reason I love comedy is because I still find it fascinating. I'm not bored by it.
Yeah.
And we continue to change. We could change what we do, create things. And it makes it makes it interesting. I literally think we should do a travel show of you and me in a caravan going around old Victorian lunatic asylums.
Oh,
Channel
5 brilliant.
Will buy that in a second. Channel 5 will buy that.
They're all flats now. They've all been turned into desirable accommodations, haven't
some
they?
Some of them have, but we can find the ones. There's a lot of disused ones in Scotland.
There's an amazing one in Lewisham.
Yeah. Yorkshire's got quite a few ones, haven't they? Yeah.
I mean, They're like abbeys from the dissolution of the monasteries. Mm-hmm. They're like dissolved monasteries now. They're like massive institutions that people went through that supposedly were there to be pastoral and beneficial, and now they're defunct. They've kind of got that echo.
I love anything that's abandoned. I'm obsessed by abandoned places. Yeah. We started off, as I say, just before we finished, talking about self-confidence being one of the reasons why you started comedy.
Yeah.
Do you think that it has helped that self-confidence? Did you get what you wanted?
It's still a construct. So the confidence I have is still based on this construct. And sometimes I find it useful to remind myself that in a way I haven't got any self-confidence. That the thing to do is, you know, to sort of re-peg it and go, well, the reason you got into this was to deliver yourself a version of self-confidence. But in lots of ways, you have no confidence in what you do. And that's reflect. I mean, I play the drums, but I've never studied it really hard. And I know why. It's because what I'm worried about is running into the things I can't do, which would shatter ever wanting to do it again. So I've learned the thing. There's things I can do. I've learned a way to play. I've got a way of playing. And it suits me. Because if I really apply myself, I've realised that I haven't got the coordination, I haven't got the actual full on musicality that, and I know lots of professional musicians that the thing they did where they practiced for 8 hours a day from when they were 9 to when they were 18. You know, I never did that. I bluffed. I'm a bluffer. And bluffers often are bluffing because they have got no confidence in what they're doing. So they muss it out, they bluff, they erect a sort of papier-mâché thing that ought to be a solid object, you know. And I very much feel like that often about what I do. I mean, with stand-up it's different because I put the hours in, I actually applied myself, you know. I did the time, I'm still do it if I had to write a show for the end of the summer, that's what would happen. The blinkers go on, eyes down, I'd write the darn thing, I'd learn it, I'd buff it up, perfect it and everything. But everything else, lots of my friends would probably disagree, but that's how I feel about myself, is that my self-confidence is a construct. Mm-hmm. And it's a construct because of an essential lack of confidence, a feeling, I can't possibly do that, I can't possibly pull that off, I'm not up to it, I'm not as clever as the clever people, I'm not as musical as the musical people and all that. And it's kind of in a lack of it. But I think... If you know that about yourself, if you're addressing that, then but not getting bogged down in it, you're probably okay. But you know, it's also a midlife thing. I turn 50 in a fortnight, and you start thinking, what's it all about?
Yeah.
You know, when you're 30, you're thinking, 20 years of stand up. That sounds like the dream ticket. Now it just feels like, oh, fuck me. Right?
When I meet 18-year-olds just starting out in comedy, and they're like, I'm thinking, I started my pension 3 years ago. I haven't put enough in it. That's what I'm thinking now.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking about anything else.
Yeah, I'm thinking, when am I going to pay the interest on the you know, I've got an interest only mortgage. We're going to actually pay the mortgage off.
Yeah.
You know, like that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, and, no, absolutely.
And is that three tours, or is that going to have to be five? Because if they're because five's 10 years, you know.
How many corporates do I need to do to get the garden done?
Yeah, exactly.
That's essentially what I'm thinking.
Well, my eldest is at uni, and that's expensive.
Yep.
So I think, well, I better say yes to those corporates that I don't want to do.
I'm going to get your agent's number off you, and I'm going to pitch you and me in a caravan going around lunatic asylums.
That's a brilliant idea.
We tick lots of boxes. I mean, I'm regional and gay,
And
you're Al Murray. it's been a pleasure, mate. Thank you very,
very
much.
No, very nice to
Cheers.
Talk.
Cheers.
Yeah.
Thank you. If you enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe to the podcast wherever you download your podcast from, and then you'll automatically get next week's episode. Next week, I'll be talking to Sophie Willen.
I went through a phase where I dressed up as a cat for ages, an angry cat with kind of emotional problems, which really was just me with the emotional problems. And I was discussing it through this cat who was allergic to dairy products. It was a real...
Well, Sophie, that sounds like the best thing I've ever heard in my entire life. If you like the show, do leave us a review, as that'll help other people find it too. And if you want to get in touch, then you can email mrsbrightside@bbc.co.uk. And finally, we know this podcast talks about things that might have affected you or someone you know personally. If that's the case and you'd like some further info, head to the Mrs. Brightside page on the BBC website, and we'll put up some links to places you might find useful. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, Calman out.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavourless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.